This series, Echoes of Reformation, and we are now into the 1800s. Pastor Pete looked at the 1600s, 1700s, and the 1800s brought a few major movements. The first one is called the Second Great Awakening, and let's just dive right in. The Second Great Awakening is characterized by enthusiasm and emotion in Christian life and worship. It has an emphasis on this emotion and worship, realizing that it's okay. You know, our emotions were given to us by God. It's a part of who we are. It's okay to use them when we worship. It isn't something we have to completely block ourselves off from. And there's also an emphasis on the supernatural presence of God, which is a reaction to the rationalism and deism that was growing in influence at that time. So God is real. He is with us. He is moving among us, that idea, and also emotion in worship. And this Second Great Awakening gained momentum early in the century and was in full swing by the 1820s. It took hold mostly in the Baptist and Methodist movements, where prominent preachers saw significant increases in attendance. This was around the same time that Charles Finney, I don't know if that's a name that you're familiar with, but he was tied closely to the Second Great Awakening. Charles Finney was leading revival meetings throughout the northeast part of the country. Up-and-coming movements like Baptists and Methodists believed in encouraging emotional engagement in worship, which differed greatly from the more established churches, which were more liturgical in nature. Now, this can be taken overboard to extremes where people would seek out emotional experiences rather than Christ. Now, we know that that's not the goal. You're never looking for just an emotional high, which sometimes I think in our worship today can actually happen a lot of the time. So we're seeking Christ, but I think it's okay to use your emotions to lament in worship, to praise in worship, to pour out our beings when we are speaking to God, which is all worship is. It's just talking to God, praising God, being in the presence of God, put to music, basically. You don't need music to worship. There is a scriptural precedent, by the way, for worship that engages emotions. And we looked at one of these verses earlier today, Psalm 100. Can we read this together? Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. Come before him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. How cool is that? Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him and praise his name, for the Lord is good and his love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations. Yeah, so we're not afraid to express emotion in other ways, right? If we're at a concert, or maybe you're watching the Browns and something happens inevitably that is Browns-like, you're going to get mad, right? You might even throw something in your emotions. We express emotions whenever we're doing daily living. You know, why can't we express emotions during worship as well? And how much greater is the grace of God and the gifts that he has given us in his salvation and redemption than a game-winning field goal? So it's okay. It's okay to express emotions, to dance a little bit, or to cry a little bit, to lament, to pour it out. So the second movement I want to talk about is the holiness movement. Now, this is tied to the theology of John Wesley, which Pete laid out last week. Wesley's theology of Christian perfection produced adherents who wanted their lives to be completely governed by the holy love of God. As a result, they began to feel that they needed to keep themselves away from certain ills of society that would hinder the process of sanctification. They were seeking holiness, to be set apart for God. The Second Great Awakening and the Holiness Movement were linked together, as those who were worshiping with more emotional engagement were naturally drawn to a deeper conviction for a life of holiness, and vice versa. So, how does this apply to the Quakers? Well, the Second Great Awakening and the Holiness Movement had a big impact on the development of Quakerism and Friends, which are interchangeable terms, were even more so in the 1800s. They were impacted by these movements. their theology, their worship, their doctrine, as these movements were spreading in the United States. Quakers in the U.S. were curious about this new, exciting, influential movement. They would attend these camp meetings. You might have seen that picture of a Methodist camp meeting just a little bit ago. They were heavily influenced by both their worship styles and their doctrines. Early friends who would later found the EFCER maintained their Quaker distinctives, but welcomed and embraced these changes, which is the reason why we no longer today have silent meetings like they did then. The Quakers, also influenced by the theological and doctrinal emphases of these movements, began to get involved in many social reforms. And this is where we get to the really good stuff that I'm excited to share with you today. In the 1700s and 1800s, these were issues, you'll see on the screen, that the Quakers were on the front lines of. Women's rights, prison reform, safety and education of children, treatment of people with disabilities and mental health issues, treatment of Native Americans. Now, this one is really interesting because the Quakers were among some of the only groups that really got along with the Native Americans. You know, a lot of the early settlers were pushing the Native Americans out. You know, you can have this little corner and we're kind of just taking over. The Quakers got along with them. There's actually stories that I don't have time to get into of Native Americans showing up at Quaker silent meetings, sat in the back and just respectfully sat until the end. They shook hands. They went to dinner together. It's kind of cool to know. Oh, and also at that time, Quakers, and even specifically the Ohio Yearly Meeting, which is now the EFCER to which we belong, the Ohio Yearly Meeting devoted money toward the education of Native Americans. Hey, we have resources. Why don't we share these with you? And they built a schoolhouse to help educate and poured resources into the Native Americans, which is pretty cool. And then the one we're going to spend a lot of time on today is abolition. Did you know that Quakers were among the first groups to denounce slavery? In the 1700s, it would have been an easy decision for them. They saw the way these men and women were treated, and it was awful. I don't need to even tell you, I'm sure you're familiar with all these atrocities, like being abused, the slaves, physically and verbally. They were beaten and whipped. They were muzzled at times. They were sometimes yoked together at the neck and forced to do certain things. They worked in horrible conditions. And there's pictures of these that I, you know, went across this week, but I just couldn't stomach sharing them because they are just gut-wrenching things to think that a human could do this to another human. Awful. They were put in shackles. Like these. Can you imagine the toll that this would take on the flesh of your ankle? These are heavy. They were bound, literally chains. They were forced, I mentioned, to work in horrible conditions. They were put on plantations to work to produce cotton, sugar, and indigo dye. Well, Quakers saw all of this, and they said, no way. We are having no part of this. In fact, many Quakers boycotted cotton, sugar, and indigo dye. They stopped wearing any black clothing because the indigo dye went into the black clothing that they would wear. But they went farther than that. They started to help free slaves. So Quakers lived all throughout the eastern United States, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania. They lived all in these slave territories. And so many of them would begin to help free the slaves, send them on the Underground Railroad that began to exist around that time. Well, as you can imagine, the slaveholders did not like that one bit. So they began instituting legislation directly at the Quakers. The North Carolina Assembly in 1796 enacted laws aimed directly at the Quakers and making sure that they couldn't set their slaves free and all that. Well, you can imagine that the environment quickly became hostile for the Quakers living in North Carolina and all those southern states. So they began to look for another place to live. We want to get away from the slavery. We don't want to have anything to do with it. And so when the Northwest Territory was established in 1787 by an ordinance of Congress following the Revolutionary War, you didn't know you were getting a history lesson today, this mostly unsettled land was very attractive to many Quakers in the South who wanted to disassociate themselves from slavery. So they packed up and they headed north or west to the Northwest Territory. There were also a number of Quakers who had come to Pennsylvania with William Penn, including Gordon Dunn's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. How cool is that? He came over with William Penn and then settled in Ohio. So many of these Quakers from Pennsylvania and these other states all ended up in Ohio, which was established in 1803. Written into the legislation of this Northwest Territory was that slavery was prohibited. So the Quakers were like, okay, we can get on board with this, let's go. So they end up in Ohio, many are quite saturated in Northeast Ohio. They were among the first people to settle here in Salem, hence the moniker, the Quaker City. Yeah, the Quaker City. These Salem Quakers began meeting together in Samuel Davis's log cabin, and in 1804 established the community of friends that today, over 200 years later, is this very body of believers, First Friends Church. How cool is that? This is a replica of Samuel Davis's log cabin, which I found out just after first service that Samuel Davis's wife was Achille, was her last name. And yes, related to Leonard and Lawrence Achille, which I thought is awesome. And sorry, lost my train of thought. So they're here in Salem. They established Salem. If you've ever wondered why Friends churches are so saturated in Ohio, this is why. Isn't that crazy? That it's because of an indirect result of slavery and the stern beliefs of the Quakers that slavery was evil. Let's go to Ohio, and now we have all these Friends churches. Kind of crazy. Salem became a center point in the anti-slavery movement in Ohio. They established the Western Anti-Slavery Society in 1842, and then 3 years later, in 1845, they began this publication. The first two issues, I believe, were in Lisbon, were created and printed in Lisbon, and then they quickly moved it to Salem because Salem was safer for this kind of a movement because of all the Quakers. Wasn't that interesting? That's not the only time that people were like, let's go to Salem, because it was safe for the anti-slavery movement, because it was so involved. This paper had a motto, no union with slaveholders. One quote I read said that this paper waged an incessant, fearless, and aggressive warfare upon the institution of human slavery. They called themselves disunion abolitionists, they called themselves covenanters, they called themselves infidels. They were ready for this fight. So that brings us to the Underground Railroad and Salem's connection to it and involvement in it. Here's a quote that I want to share directly with you. Known as the Quaker City, it is no wonder that it is one of the first places thought of when the Underground Railroad is mentioned. Nearly everyone was somehow involved, and legend says that if a slaveholder tracked a fugitive to Salem, he would just turn around and leave. As he knew, the people would never give up the fugitive. The slave hunters were said to have feared for their lives if they had to enter Salem. Those rough pacifists, they'll get you. There were five principal escape routes that went through Northeast Ohio once the fugitive slaves got across the Ohio River. Four of those five main routes went through Salem. Salem was very much involved. But it wasn't always easy for the Quakers. In 1850, the Fugitive Slave Law was passed. And this made things dangerous. It meant that if you were caught aiding the fugitive slaves, then you could be sentenced to 6 months imprisonment and a $1,000 fine, which today is over $30,000. This is a poster from Boston, but it is very much indicative of what you might have seen somewhere in Salem, where people are basically issuing a warning. Hey, fugitive slaves, watch out. Like, there are slave hunters around. They're trying to get you. We want to look out for you. Just be careful. There was very much a vibe of wanting to look out. Here's another quote. Active participation distressed many Quakers, not only because it was a violation of the Fugitive Slave Law, but because it necessitated lying when questioned by the authorities. And Quakers traditionally prided themselves on maintaining a reputation for strict honesty. Which brings us to our first anecdote, right, which I found very interesting. We're going to look at a few houses from the Underground Railroad that are here in Salem. On Lincoln Avenue, Dr. John C. Winery owned his home, and he was a dentist. Actually, in his spare time, he became a dentist. He had two daughters, and he was very active in the anti-slavery movement. His home became a leading station on the Underground Railroad, and there was a loft above his kitchen where he could hide about six fugitive slaves with a cleverly hidden trap door. One of the tales associated with this home is that his daughter Abby was playing on the gate to the home outside, and some slave hunters came and asked her, "Hey, are there any slaves in your home?" And she just looked at them and said, "No." Simply said, "No, there are not." And they believed her. She's a young Quaker girl. She would not lie, so they went on their way. But then Dr. Winery, her father, came and asked her about it. Because he knew full well that there were six fugitive slaves hiding above the kitchen. But she assured her father that she had not lied, as her Quaker teachings had taught her that no one was a slave. Semantics. A six-year-old girl, are you kidding me? This is a picture on the right of his actual desk, which is now at, we have it here in Salem at Freedom Hall at the Salem Historical Society. It's pretty cool. A picture of him there, kind of blown up so you could see him. We'll talk a little bit more about Freedom Hall in just a second, actually. But let's look at our next house. It is owned by Sam Reynolds. And he lent the upstairs of this carpenter shop for secret meetings of the Anti-Slavery Society. They would meet all over. They would meet in the town hall while they could. It became dangerous eventually and not allowed eventually. They would meet in schools or in churches. But when they couldn't, Sam Reynolds said, "Hey, come on over to my place right above my workshop. You can use my upstairs." And so they held a lot of meetings up there, and they dubbed it Liberty Hall. So Liberty Hall they made a replica of Liberty Hall at some point, which is now off Pershing, and it is dubbed Freedom Hall, which is now a museum. If you ever get a chance, go in there. You can see what life was like in the 1800s. You can go upstairs. They have tons of resources and really cool artifacts from this time period, talking all about anti-slavery and abolition, the movement in Salem. It's really cool. Well, one of the things up there, like I mentioned, is Dr. Winery's desk. But there's also this hiding place. You check out this very nice, we have a very nice shelving unit here. But if you know where that latch is, you open that up, you have a hiding place for about six or so fugitive slaves. And that would have been just like Sam Reynolds' place, because there were two hiding places in that building. Let's talk about Daniel Howell Heiss real quick. He was a Quaker blacksmith. He learned roofing, tool making. He was known for keeping a journal for more than 30 years, which is a rich resource for life in the 1800s. But his home had three hiding places. You can see pictures. The one on the right there is a window that was a fake window. You could open it up, climb through there. His journal of more than 30 years is available for free at the Salem Public Library website. You can download it and check it out. It's searchable. It's really cool. A lot of time was put into that. But it is a wealth of knowledge regarding life in the 1800s. One of his entries was from April 8th, 1849, and it says this. They arrived about 7:30. Seven fugitive slaves by way of the Underground Railroad from Wheeling, Virginia, probably West Virginia now as we know it. Welcome, welcome to the protection I can give with or without the law. Kind of cool. He apparently wasn't too secretive all the time about it. He was a member of the Anti-Slavery Society that was headquartered here in Salem, and they held regular meetings. They often had prominent speakers come through town to talk. During one meeting, a very unique event took place, and Heiss recorded it in his journal, which is awesome. Listen to his recollection of that day. August 28, 1854. Clear and warm. Nothing doing on the brickyard. Don Rice is here with his circus. Attended the sessions, which was very interesting. At 4:00, it was announced that cars were due from the east at 6:00 containing a slave. When our meeting adjourned, it adjourned to meet at the depot. As soon as the train cars arrived, a few friends walked deliberately onto them and asked a certain man in the vicinity of the supposed slave if she was really a slave. He answered that she belonged to him And no sooner than which, they just picked the girl up and hurried her out of the car. His wife shrieked and he hollered murder as lustily as he knew how, but all to no purpose. He went on without the slave girl, but cursed and swore at a round rate about it. He gave us her clothes before leaving. Well, that's nice of him. In the evening, a meeting was held to talk about the rescue, at which about $50 was took up to defray the expense that might be incurred in clothing and education for her. She was also provided with a name, Abby Kelly Salem. The Quakers abducted a slave right out of slavery. How cool is that? Man, they were hardcore. One account mentions that it was about 100 people that did this. They were in this meeting. They all left. They were cheering, celebrating, causing a ruckus. They weren't even being discreet about it. They went down to the train. They grabbed her from Mr. and Mrs. Robinson was their name. They named her Abby Kelly Salem, which was in honor of this girl, Abby Kelly Foster, which was a renowned speaker. Here's a picture of her. And she had just come through Salem on her tour speaking. So they named her Abby Kelly and gave her the last name Salem in honor of the town that got her out of slavery. Abby Kelly Salem was then taken in by one of Heiss's best friends, Joel McMillan, and his wife, and they raised her as one of their own. One quote I read says that the girl grew up to splendid womanhood and was highly esteemed by all who knew her. Pretty cool. So Joel McMillan, to touch on him real quick, he was a very close friend, as I mentioned, to Daniel Howell Heiss. His home had a fireplace that opened up into a secret alcove, which you can see in the next picture. There was a secret alcove behind the fireplace, and it was so well built that that fireplace could be closed off. They could light a fire, hang out in the living room, and there were times they even had to host slave hunters, which were in town. They would all be hanging out with the slave hunters. There's the fire, slaves hidden right behind it. No one knew no one was the wiser. Pretty cool. Jonas Cattell, our neighbors here at the church, 999 Jennings Avenue was where this house was. He was a justice of the peace, a two-time senator. His home was riddled with hiding places like this closet. You open it up, there's the clothes. Behind the clothes, there's another door where you could hide slaves. Pretty cool stuff. The last place that I want to share with you is the Stagecoach Inn. My wife and I drive by this all the time when we go out to Canton. I always love their signage. I don't know, has anyone else noticed this? Like, instead of saying, today's special, like, fresh cod or whatever, it'll just say, like, fish. Well, just yesterday, my wife was driving by, and she got this picture. Yeah, soup, yeah. Well, I like soup. Well, not very specific, but hey, whatever works, whatever works. So, Georgetown Road, Stagecoach Inn was established in 1822 as an inn by Samuel Sturgeon, who was named as an agent of the Underground Railroad. So that would imply that his inn itself was a station, and there was an underground tunnel, literally underground. Now, the Underground Railroad was not all underground. Many of you know that. I think that's something that often comes up, though, as a question. It is not all underground. It just means it's hidden. Well, this was a literal underground tunnel from the inn to another brick house nearby. It was pretty cool, which was another station on the railroad. So now I want to get to Edwin and Barclay Coppock, because the Salem area has a martyr in Edwin Coppock. These two brothers were born in Winona. Isn't that cool, the resemblance? They look exactly alike. They seem like they're twins, but they're just brothers. They're born 4 years apart. Edwin in 1835, Barclay in 1839, grew up in Winona in this atmosphere of anti-slavery. Under the influence of these impassioned teachings, it was ingrained in their very nature that all men were created equal and slavery was a crime against God and man. So they took action. But they did it in a different way. To make a long story short, they joined up with the famous abolitionist John Brown, and they were involved at Harper's Ferry when they were trying to fight and to free slaves at Harper's Ferry, where John Brown was caught. He was hanged, and then Barclay was there. He escaped narrowly, I believe, in coming across this story, and Edwin, though, was caught. Also, John Brown's sons were caught, and they were executed by shooting. And Edwin, 2 weeks after John Brown, was hanged on the same gallows that John Brown was hanged. And there's letters from Edwin to John Brown's wife about his sons and his her husband, and a letter from Edwin to his uncle, one of the last things he ever wrote. And man, the passion and the strength and the fervor with which these Quakers fought this injustice and they fought for reformation is pretty astounding. There's so much more. Salem was so involved in the Underground Railroad that, and renowned for it, that it caught the attention of the Confederate General Morgan and his infamous raiders. Morgan said he was going to burn Salem and water his horses in Lake Erie. And he meant it. So Salem prepared. Daniel Howell Heiss was given the job of cutting down trees, laying them across South Lincoln, what is now South Lincoln, to stop the rebel cavalrymen. There were over 500 armed men patrolling Salem's streets waiting for Morgan. However, he never made it that far north. He was captured in southern Columbiana County. But this occurrence marks the northernmost engagement of the Civil War. Kind of crazy. There's more stories about Salem's anti-slavery movement, Quaker involvement, houses in the Underground Railroad, and other movements of the Quakers like women's suffrage, which really took the forefront after the Civil War. Once this issue was kind of more settled, they moved on, changed directions, and really fought for women's rights. So there's more. You can go to the Salem Historical Society. There's a wealth of information there. You can check out their resources, take their guided trolley tour around town where they'll talk about all these houses and get much more information. You could grab a brochure and an audio tour as recorded by our very own Richard Tice, which is awesome. You could take a tour of Liberty Hall, which is that replica building off of Pershing. You can learn about the rich heritage that we as friends have, which we should be proud of, which is pretty cool, and also that Salem has itself in their efforts. So before I go any further, I want to thank Dave Stratton, David Shivers, and Elaine Ryder. They gave me so much information. They gave me time, resources, and I learned a ton from them. And they were so gracious with that, so I wanted to thank them. I also came across Gordon Dunn when I was at the Salem Historical Society. He helps out there, and I learned something awesome about him that I'd like to show you. My man. He didn't know I was filming that. You may be wondering, what does that have to do with the Underground Railroad? Well, I'll tell you. Nothing. I just wanted you to see Gordon at his best. So, to bring this full circle, it seems that the Second Great Awakening had awakened the church to remember the biblical idea of the Imago Dei in every person. The Imago Dei, the image of God. We are created. Oh man, it brings back those lyrics. When I in awesome wonder consider all the works thy hands have made. God made it all. We were created in his image. I'm not going to read this right now. I'm going to keep going. But if every person has been made in God's image, like Genesis 1 tells us, then each person deserves to be treated with respect, honor, and love. This image bearing did not apply to men only. It did not apply to certain skin colors. It did not apply only to the innocent. All are included. John 10:14-16. I do want to read this one. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me and I know the Father and I lay my life down for the sheep, I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. So he's speaking to, I'm going to come back to that. Psalm 100 declares, we read that together, we are his people, the sheep of his pasture. So here in John 10, Jesus is speaking about being the good shepherd, and he was clear that there were other sheep. So Jesus is talking to Jewish people, so the implication is that these other sheep are the Gentiles. But if you remember, the Jewish people would have seen the Gentiles as outside of this Imago Dei, this image-bearing status. They were others. They were very much not included in their minds. But Jesus is saying, no, One shepherd, one flock, I mean them too. They were also created in my image. That criminal over there was also created in my image. That woman here at the well was created in my image as well. We are all created in his image. One flock with one shepherd. I love that idea. So we're going to take just a minute for some closing questions today, just to get us thinking. Who is in chains today? We may not see these used the way they were 200 years ago, but you better believe that there are people in chains today. Who might be in chains? We talked about sex trafficking this summer. That is a huge issue, and it's not just one that is overseas, somewhere else. It is here in Ohio. Talk to Becca Russell if you want any more information on that. It's a huge issue. Child labor. The opioid crisis. Another one close to home. Poverty. These are chains. How can the church work to liberate people from chains today? Why do we have, question number two, why do we have the tendency to overlook or ignore the image of God, the Imago Dei, in others? Have we been tempted to adopt to an us versus them mentality when it comes to our perspective of other people groups? And finally, how can we shift toward an idea of one flock with one shepherd? Let's take just a moment. Thank you, Lord, for creating us in your image. You desire to be in communion with us. That is so humbling. I pray that you would never let us ignore that image, that Imago Dei in anyone. Continue to remind us that you have created us as one flock with one shepherd. Thank you for the reminder of what our Quaker brothers and sisters of 200 years ago were passionate about. What the founders of this very church were fighting against for the sake of your name. I pray that you would stir in us a desire to be change in this world like they were, to fight for reformation. Continue to move in us and speak to us and convict us. Amen.